Welcome to this podcast number 445. It's a few days before the season finale of the mid-season finale of Walking Dead and Talking Dead. Robert Kirkman's going to be on, and Lauren Cohan, and a surprise cast member guest. So watch that. Watch that. We will help you deal with whatever happens in the mid-season finale. I haven't seen it yet, but I have yet to see a finale where, you know, they were like, oh, we're fine. Everything's fine.
We're fine. Check back with us in a few months.
Yeah, check back with us. We'll be fine in a couple months. We, you know. So I don't know what's going to happen. I haven't seen it yet. I'm very excited to see. I can't watch ahead, Katie, because if all those facts are stuck in my head, I cannot contain them. So it's as much to protect me from myself as anything else, because I would want to talk about it.
Yeah,
I would want to be my own Talking Dead. I could just sit on a couch and stare in a mirror and be like, I'm Chris Hardwick. And then I could thank myself. Thank you, Chris Hardwick, for talking me through this. I'd like to thank HostGator for sponsoring this episode of the Nerds Podcast. Plans start at just how much, Katie?
$347.
Damn, you're good. Yep. That's if you want to build a one-stop quality website. That's what you would do, is go to HostGator.com. They'll make it simple, and your website's going to look fantastic, and it'll be quick and painless. Let's face it, a good .com, there really aren't that many left.
No.
So why not try a .net?
Yeah.
At one point, it was not necessarily the same thing, but essentially it's the same thing now.
Yeah, and you can get the name that you want.
You can actually get the name that you want. Yeah. So if you wanted to get katieful.net.
I could.
That would probably sound like an adult site. but if it's not, if it's just things that Katie Levine likes, mm-hmm. you know, it'd be like, then that's what you would go to HostGator and get that for almost no money every month. So build your website, get your domain. They have a drag-and-drop builder, or if you use WordPress, that's fine, too. There's no need to code. They make it super easy. Head over to HostGator.com, get some hosting, buy some .NETs, and use the coupon code NERDIST to get an extra 30% off and support this very program, or programmy, if you're British. And this episode, speaking of British, is Thomas Dolby, and I have always been a huge, huge, huge Thomas Dolby fan. That guy, to me, was like a beacon for young nerds, because he sort of had that kind of, like, steampunk almost, you know,
yeah.
Jules Verne time traveler kind of, and the technological stuff that he was doing was above what, like, he had these insane setups that no one else had. I mean, now you can just make stuff on your phone,
yeah.
But he had this setup that was just hundreds of thousands of dollars to create these electronic sounds that he had. And, you know, She Blinded Me with Science, I know, is the big hit, but there's so many other great Thomas Dolby songs. And like Aliens Ate My Buick was an album that I listened to a shit ton when I was in high school. And so I adore Thomas Dolby. And when we were doing the Nerdist TV show, I went over to England and I got to sit down with him. And he basically lives in this house that is next to a lighthouse. And he had a tour called the Invisible Lighthouse Tour, which was a very interactive tour that just ended. But if he does more, you should go see them. He did one here at Hollywood Forever that he did just a couple days ago here in Los Angeles. But he basically, his recording studio is a fire ship, like an old, like one of those old little tugboaty, like fireboats that would, you know, put out other fires on other boats. And so it's basically parked sort of like how a redneck would have a Camaro up on blocks. He has a boat up on blocks, like a blue neck. Would that be right? British?
Yeah.
So that's right next to these old, like, Napoleonic lighthouses that on this beach that he lives. And his recording studio is in this old boat. And I got to go hang out with him there when we did the Nerds TV show. And he's so awesome. And then we just went and had tea in Thomas Dolby's house. I just had tea with him.
It's so British.
And he has these, like, weird, crazy-looking contraptions. It's very much... he very much seems like a mad scientist, but he's a lovely, lovely fellow, and he happened to be in town. And so here he is, a guy that I have adored for many years. The Nerds Podcast, number 445, with Thomas Dolby.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Thomas Dolby in America! I'm so excited you're here. You know I geeked out on you when I hung out with you at your house.
Well, where did we last meet, Chris?
Well, the last time we met was I was over in England shooting some stuff for BBC, and we came out to your home on the beach next to the Napoleonic tower apartments. And we recorded in
those aren't very tall, right?
They're tall.
Okay.
And then we recorded in your lifeboat recording studio.
That's right.
We talked for about a half hour, and then you made me tea. And it was lovely tea.
Oh, good.
So I was glad to get you here because these guys are also on the show, and now we'll have some more time to talk and chat. So
they couldn't afford to get us all out there.
They really couldn't.
No, they couldn't.
Yeah. It's BBC.
Someone
to be honest, our rates were insanely high.
That's
I don't know
true.
Why we asked for a bagillion dollars.
Well, we also asked for the Concorde to be reinstated and to be flown on that. It didn't work out. Yeah.
So, is Invisible Lighthouse is the Lighthouse tour done for now?
Yeah, I just finished the 3-month tour.
How was it?
It's great. Yeah, and I'm a zombie. And I'm flying back tonight.
Oh, you're going back to London tonight? Where did you start the tour, and where'd you guys go?
It actually started in Mill Valley at the Mill Valley Film Festival in the US part. I mean, I'd already done I think 25 dates in the UK.
Yeah.
And then we went across to Florida and then anti-clockwise ending up back in California again.
Oh, wow.
And two shows at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery.
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
On Friday night, which was a lot of fun. And that was the end of it.
Which you had asked me to do, and I was going, I said, yes, I would love to do that. And then my mom said, it was the day before my birthday, and she was like, can we do a birthday dinner? And I was like, oh, all right. And then I ended up, and then my father passed away, and then I ended up having to go do that. So
right here, I'm sorry to hear.
No, that's okay. That's okay. So I totally couldn't be there because of that, so I totally apologize.
He's just excited to use an excuse that's viable right now.
No. I mean, it does. I do get to play that card.
Oh, for at least 3 more weeks, yeah.
3 weeks?
You get 3 full weeks of excuse.
I feel like I get a couple months.
Yeah, it's a couple months.
Oh, no, not yet.
Like I said before, Matt, you have no emotions. You have
that's
no
true.
Place
no,
to
no,
say.
No. For a grandmother, you get a couple of weeks. For a father,
you get a
couple months.
Day and a half.
You're a cold-hearted bastard.
This is the most lighthearted, dark conversation I've ever heard.
Yeah, I guess for the tone is just like we're talking about shopping.
Yeah,
that's really what we're talking about. So how was the show received? And Mill Valley is awesome, by the way.
No, it's great. No, it's gone really well. I mean, I project the film and I do the soundtrack live, so I'm playing the score and narrating the film, and then I have a live Foley artist on stage.
Oh, that's awesome. Brad.
He's got trays of leaves and pebbles from my beach and so on, and he's got stuffed bird wings that he does that with, and duck calls, and he does the ocean surf with a tray of bull bearings and stuff, and he plays guitar as well.
That's really cool.
That's really rad.
Yeah. Is it all instrumental? Or are you singing? Or
No, I'm singing. There's like 6 songs related to the area that you came to. Ranging from Cloudburst at Shingle Street and Wind Power that I wrote in 1980 through to the Lifeboats and Oceaneer that are from my last album last year.
Oh, wow. Is it the Nutmeg of Consolation?
Correct.
Yes. That's the name of the boat. Now, let's talk a little. This is some of the stuff that we talked about when I chatted with you for BBC, but they didn't use all of it. So I'm going to ask you some repeat questions. But hopefully you've forgotten what I asked you in the last 2 years. Where did you start, and what was the music scene like when you started, and what sort of pulled you in the direction of? Because I want to hear about you had an insane setup. You had an insane electronic setup pretty much before anyone else had an insane electronic setup.
Well, electronic keyboards and synths were very rarefied when I started out. You know, I mean, so we're talking mid-70s in London, and you know, I can remember hearing rumors that the Beatles and the Beach Boys had used synthesizers, but the first time they were credited on an album was Pink Floyd, you know, would mention this mysterious VCS3. And to those of us that were into progressive music back then, this was the first time that a synth had been credited on an album. And that was terribly exciting. But they were very bulky and expensive and didn't stay in tune. And they were really the sole domain of super rich bands and rock stars or university experimental music departments. And if you were clever, you could hang out where the skips are behind the university music departments and find circuit boards that you could take home and solder together.
Oh, wow.
You know, to make your own stuff. And so there was this sort of this underground electronic scene in London and also up in the north of England. And this was while punk was exploding, you know, in notoriety, which, and it couldn't have been much further from punk, but there was this sort of, you know, alter movement going on you know, electronic pop.
Did traditional traditional bands look down on electronic music as like, well, that's not real music, or would they? Did everyone kind of think it was cool at the
time?
No,
they thought it was not real music. They definitely thought it. I mean, you know, it's interesting, right? From then through about the end of the 90s, there was this permanent tussle going on between sort of indie guitar drum bands and electronic artists. And but it was sort of, in a way, electronic music was legitimized, well, by two things, one in the 70s, one in the 80s. That the move in the 70s was Bowie going to Berlin with Eno. And he had been influenced by krautrock bands, you know, Tangerine Dream and Kraftwerk and so on. And he was making pop records, you know, with all electronics, which were making it in the charts, you know, things like Sound and Vision and so on. So that was a big deal because Bowie had always been like a mentor, you know, to my generation, sort of musically and fashion-wise. And so the fact that he'd gone over to electronics after, you know, really at the peak of his success with Young Americans and Fame and stuff like that, you know, over here, he went to Berlin and did this sort of obscure electronic stuff. So that was exciting. The other key moment really was when the dregs of Joy Division, who are really the perennial sort of indie band, reformed as New Order and started making electronic disco, you know, dance music with things like, Power Corruption and Lies, which is the album that, that their biggest hits came from. And they were using synths and sequencers, and that was really exciting.
There was something that I never thought about or heard about, and they showed it kind of for a second in the 24-Hour Party People movie, where they did New Order write the songs on guitars and then transfer it over and like record them digitally?
I think it was probably that they would get synth grooves going in the studio and then jam along on guitar, because it's hard to jam with sequencers. But if you play along with guitar, you can do that. Yeah.
And you were saying like the whole punk thing was going on. So like the electronic scene was like its own separate thing with its own separate shows and stuff like that.
Definitely. Yeah. And you know, a lot of electronic music at the time was about the coldness and the alienation. You know, it was Gary Numan up there with lots of eyeliner, with blaring neon lights behind him, blasting out and blinding you. And it was really about coldness and alienation.
Yeah.
That wasn't me though. I mean, I was more into the warmth. I was basically a songwriter that, you know, 10 years earlier, I would have been at the piano like Elton John or Billy Joel or something like that. But now there was the availability of synths that gave me a wider palette. But I came at it from a different angle.
Yeah, yeah. And because like, and Gary Numan, he's with the Two-Way Army, was still pretty, like that was pretty guitar driven before he turned into just going solo with a lot of the digital stuff, right?
Exactly, yeah. But it was really, you know, his performances on Top of the Pops that sort of, you know, gave that whole thing its liftoff.
Oh, really?
Then where does Jeff Lynne come in? Where does he slide into all that stuff?
He's everywhere. Well, I mean, not really. He was. We associated him with a previous generation, you know, because the Electric Light Orchestra were a pop group that used orchestral instruments, used electronics. He's a brilliant producer, you know, did some pretty amazing things. He experimented with vocoders on Mr. Blue Sky and stuff like that. But it wasn't pure electronic music. You know, and so we didn't really associate with him.
Did you ever play with Bowie or hang out with Bowie?
Yeah, I played with Bowie at Live Aid in 1985.
Oh my God. Was it the first time you had met him, or had you met him before?
No, I met him 4 days before Live Aid. you know, they announced Live Aid, and it all happened very, very quickly, as you probably know from the documentaries and history books. But he was in England at the time shooting a movie called Labyrinth.
Yes.
That he acted in. At Pinewood or Elstree Studios, one of the, you know, studios outside London. And his regular touring band were not available. And so he asked me to help him put together a band in a hurry. And at the time, you know, I think he thought it was going to be a promotional opportunity. So he had a current single, Loving the Alien, which is sort of lost in the sands of time, which he wanted us to play because he said he'd be promoting his current single. But as he got focused on it, he realized it was bigger than that. It wasn't about that. It was about the anthems.
Yeah.
And so he kept changing his mind about what songs to do. And this band that I had, you know, that all had grown up adoring him, hanging on his every word, we knew all the songs, but we never got to rehearse them, you know, because up until the night before Live Aid, he was changing his mind about what songs to do. But he was very debonair and gentlemanly about it. And it was odd because there was a BBC documentary called Cracked Actor that you may have seen, where it was just him as the thin white Duke at the height of his of his addiction and so on. There's this famous scene from it where he's got this long, long stretch limousine and he's in the back, this tiny figure, and he's got a carton of milk and he's completely strung out and he's going, there's a fly in my milk. I'm like that fly. And I was expecting the Cracked Actor, you know, but instead it was like Edward Fox, you know, this sort of guy. And the one time that he was like the Cracked Actor, we took a helicopter into Wembley Stadium and it was only a 10-minute flight from Battersea, but and he's terrified of flying. And during that time, his hat was pulled down over his head, his chain smoking. He's going, can we land here, please?
No. Smoking in the helicopter?
Yeah, yeah. And the pilot was going, it's really bad for the avionics. Mr. Bowie, could you extinguish your cigarette? It's bad for my avionics. Sod off.
He'll be a lot nicer when we land. Yeah. He's going to be a lot nicer. I mean, especially by that point, he had already broken way mainstream. And I guess... from what I've read or what I understand was he had come out of that period of like Let's Dance and all that where, and he wasn't really happy about that explosion of his pop career.
I'm not sure if he was ever happy. I mean, the guy's naturally so uncomfortable, he's got to move on to the next thing, you know, and carve out the next chapter.
So when did you start kind of finding, you know, going from tinkering with electronics to finding what it was that was your sound? Because for me... You, as a guy who was so enamored of what I didn't realize at the time were sort of, you know, nerdy, heady things, your persona was very much this kind of like nerdy mad scientist guy. Mm. And so I loved watching you as much as I enjoyed the music. Mm. So was that just a natural extension of who you are? Or do you feel like, you know, did you sort of search for the persona or what happened?
You know, and when I started performing as a soloist, I looked at sort of pin-up pop stars like Adam Ant or Sting or Simon Le Bon, and I thought, well, I'm never going to compete in those stakes, so it's better to draw something out from inside me. Now, I'm from a very literary background. My father was a professor of classical archaeology at Oxford University. Oh, wow. My mother taught calculus. You know, there's more PhDs in my family than I can count, and a totally non-show business background. You know, if we were watching an old film as a family, six kids in the family, we'd be watching an old movie, and if the orchestra welled up because somebody was about to break into song, everybody got embarrassed. Tea, darling. And people would sort of disperse, right? But I was like sucking it all up like a sponge. I'd be up on the coffee table, you know, trying to copy Fred and Ginger's steps, you know, and singing along with some, you know, pathetic, you know, song. But so I was really drawn to that showbiz side, and although I'm basically introverted, I have this sort of exhibitionist streak that comes out from time to time.
In front of, is it activated when you get in front of like a, because it's funny that people, you know, I find sometimes that I'm uncomfortable with people one-on-one, but there could be 10,000 people in an audience and I would feel totally fine.
Well, a 10,000 person audience is very anonymous in some ways, you know, it's like it's surreal, I think. You know, I think a small audience is a lot harder sometimes, and you can see individual faces. And yeah, I mean, I'm less socially able, you know, when I'm just with one person or with a few people. So I'm certainly like that. You know, I have this odd creative process where I visualize an empty spotlight on a stage and a guy walks into the spotlight and starts singing a song. What does it sound like? I just strain my ears and I try and hear that first chord, you know, and the first line of vocals, and that's how I write. So it's like I work backwards from, you know, there needs to be a stage, and I work backwards from the stage, and what are we going to fill that space with?
Yeah. What was the first song that you remember where you really started to feel like, oh, I think I'm onto something. I think there is an active vein, there is an ore underneath this that I really feel like I can mine for a while.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it was in the early days as a songwriter, I guess a lot of songwriters like this, it was bits and pieces of things. It was an intro here, it was a chorus there, you know, I couldn't really string it all together. But I think I sort of learned my craft as a songwriter when I was still not 20 yet. I toured the US as a keyboard player with a band called Bruce Woolley and the Camera Club, and we were supporting Lena Lovitch, who was a bit of a punk diva, a sort of punk cabaret diva back then, and she was on the Stiff label, you know, so she's label mates with, you know, Elvis Costello and Nick Lowe and people like that. And we toured with her, and it's just when the Porter Studio had come out. The Porter Studio was a four-track cassette machine. It only would record on one side, but, you know, a stereo cassette has got four tracks in it, right? Two on each side. So it would use all four tracks. So it allowed you to do multi-track taping. It had a little mixer built into it. So I had this in my hotel room on tour and a little drum machine, and I was writing songs, and I was very impressed with Lena. I was trying to write songs that I could give to Lena that she would be interested in covering. And I wrote a song called New Toy, and Lena covered it. I played on it, and it went in the charts. Wow. And so that was really the start of everything for me.
Well, when did you decide, I think I want to be the guy, I think I want to step out and be the solo artist?
So that attracted some attention in the industry. And as a keyboard player, I was starting to get hired for sessions. I made these cassettes, and I sent them around record companies and publishers and was getting nowhere. And I nearly got a deal, and then it fell through on the day before, and I was badly in debt. And I left London and hitched a ride to Paris in the back of a chicken lorry on the ferry. And because I got a school friend of mine was working as a busker, you know, a street musician in the Paris metro. And he showed me the ropes, and he taught me how to busk. And so I spent 6 months in Paris, playing Dylan songs for Japanese tourists. But in the midst of all of this, I got a call from somebody in England saying, Mick Jones wants you to do a session. I'm thinking, The Clash! Yes! And it turned out to be the other Mick Jones. Also a Brit in a band called Foreigner, and who I'd never heard of, actually, because they were not successful in the UK. And I heard their music, and it was this sort of, hardish rock, you know, radio rock, AOR. And they summoned me to New York, and they would leave me all night in the studio just to fill up tracks. You know, it was the days of, you know, 2-inch tape, and they'd say, we got these 5 tracks, these 7 tracks, and they'd go away and come back in the morning. Wow. To see what I'd done. And it was the first time I'd spent a lot of time in a recording studio, so I would just be experimental. You know? They gave me like a menu, like a takeout food menu of all the synths that I could rent. So I go,
oh, wow.
Well, tonight I'll have an OBXA, and I'll have a 4-voice Polymoog. And I'd just call these things in, and I'd just play around with them.
Did you know what they were at the time?
Yeah, I knew what they were, but I'd read about them in magazines. I'd never had my hands on one. And so I just messed around. Are you familiar with a song of theirs called Waiting for a Girl Like You?
Wait, of course. Yeah.
Okay, so that was a ballad, you know, when they came. Yeah.
Is that you playing?
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome.
Well, and the intro before that, which is like this sort of ambient, almost like Eno-esque, you know, floaty intro before that. And I'd dreamed up this technique. Do you know what a mellotron is?
Yeah.
Okay, so a mellotron has a recording of a note, of, let's say, flute, you know. A flute plays an A, you record it for 15 seconds. When you play the key, a little tape recorder plays that thing, right? So Strawberry Fields Forever is the famous example of that, right?
Paul has the mellotron.
Yeah. So I thought that you could create a sort of a studio mellotron by recording a single note of synth on each track of a multi-track tape recorder, and then use the faders on the mixing console, push them up and down to play chords.
Oh, that's awesome.
So I'd always wanted to do this, right? So I got a mini Moog, and I recorded a bunch of notes, and then using the faders, I pushed them up and down, and I recorded the intro to Waiting for a Girl Like You. And I really didn't think that, I thought they'd be upset that I'd spent all night doing this. But they came in and said, that's great. We're going to go with that. That's going to be the single, you know.
Do you get any writing credit on that when you create that? No.
No, because as a session player, you're hired for your ability to come up with interesting parts, so...
Oh, that's really fascinating.
He's like Vic Flick, but with a synthesizer.
And so did you do the whole album for them, or did you, what?
Yeah, well, they hired me for a night, but they liked it, and they said, "Can you stay and do the rest of the album?" I said, "Well, at that price, certainly." More money than I ever earned in my life, you know, playing music. And so I stayed for a month, did the whole album, and went home with a pocket full of cash, with which I recorded my first album.
Oh, wow.
So nice. I owned the tapes for those. So, and then, you know, their album came out. I had this Lena thing that had done well, and the record companies were coming to me, and I had an album pre-made. And I said, well, this is what you're buying into, you know. So I was able to write my own ticket.
What year was that?
1980.
Oh, that was 80. Was She Blinded Me with Science on that album?
No. So it wasn't initially. So the album came out as The Golden Age of Wireless, and it was critically very well acclaimed, and it sold about 3 copies.
And, the three critics.
But what was going on at the time was MTV was starting to get into the big cities, you know, starting to be influential. And I thought I'd like to have a crack at doing a music video. So I wrote a storyboard for a music video about this home for deranged scientists and all the rest of it. And I wanted to hire this guy, Magnus Pike, who was a BBC staple back then. And I took it to the record company and they said, interesting. Where's the song? And I said, I'll bring it in on Monday morning. And I went home for the weekend and wrote She Blinded Me with Science. And it was like, I needed to, or else they wouldn't give me the budget to make a video.
Wow. That's so
fat. So you had the stage before you had the song.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
But writing the story, like writing the visual story first and then going, I got to fit something that makes sense with this yeah. story.
Right. I mean, I remember storyboarding it, and I was on the couch, and I had this doctor that was like cross-examining me, and then I started like drawing this Japanese assistant in a lab coat, and she blinded me with science.
That's and then for the rest of Magnus Pike's life, people shouted science at him on the stage.
Oh, God, it's like,
why are you doing that?
He was so upset because he would just, you know, people would come up behind him, you know, on the sidewalk.
Science!
Scare him half out of his skin. And he was incredulous because he felt, and he said to me, you know, it would appear that your bloody MTV video is better known over there than my body of academic work.
Oh, yes, as an academic, he probably wasn't too keen on that.
Well, you know, I mean, with all respect to Bill Nye, you know, it's like you know him as a character, a personality and a celebrity. You know, you don't really look up how many theses he's had published.
Right, yeah. Right. Well, I know at that time, or at least from what I understand, from what I've read, that so much of the music that essentially drove New Wave and pop culture at the time came from England, because a lot of the American artists were like, music television, that sounds dumb. But the British artists, like, you know, you guys and Duran Duran and Buggles and Trevor Horn, all those people were like, whoa, this sounds really interesting. Like, you guys were super experimental with it. And so that's why that first essentially new wave of music was like British pop music.
Yeah, I think we were just quick to jump onto things. I mean, things generally spread, ideas spread faster in the UK because there were, at the time especially, there's only two or three ways that you would get your information. You know, there were two music shows on TV, Top of the Pops and the Old Grey Whistle Test, which is the late night stoners thing. You know, so you would get Electric Light Orchestra on Top of the Pops, and you'd get Genesis on the Old Grey Whistle Test, and it wasn't in the newspapers at all. So the moment there's a good idea, it was all over the island, all over the country in no time. You know, the nightclub owners, the journalists, the t-shirt manufacturers, everybody would jump onto something. So we didn't have our own MTV at the time. Well, there's no cable in the UK. But here's the thing. If you were unavailable, if you're someone in the charts, you're unavailable for Top of the Pops, they would show your video. If you could prove that you're off touring somewhere or whatever. So suddenly, after Top of the Pops was already getting quite staid by then, it was always the same thing, you know, screaming kids down the front, the flashing lights, the mirror balls, etc. Not very subversive, you know. But if you're someone in the charts, they booked you for Top of the Pops, you say, well, unfortunately, the band's touring South America this week, you know, but here's a video. The BBC started showing videos. So, you know, to an extent, we were aware of MTV, but part of it was like a ruse so you could get something cooler on Top of the Pops than just them doing it in the studio.
Wow. Yeah. Well, yeah, because I know people made videos before. I mean, there were definitely videos being made before MTV, but I don't know where.
Like the Beatles did Rain for Ed Sullivan because they weren't around to do it. They made a quick video for Rain.
Black Sabbath had a couple of videos too.
There were videos, and a lot of them were concert.
Beatles were first, guys. Beatles were first.
But I guess there just wasn't. I don't know what they did with videos before then. Before, you know, Top of the Pops and MTV. I think they were just promotional. Like maybe just sent them to, I don't know, record labels or something.
Yeah, I don't know how they use them anyway. I mean, there's a lot of shots of, you know, up the guitarist's trouser leg during the solo. You know, not many people writing stories and coming up with concepts around them, you know. And I think there was, you know, there was a honeymoon period after that where serious artists took an interest in their videos, you know, be it Peter Gabriel or Talking Heads or Laurie Anderson, etc., you know, where it's like, wait, I'm not just going to let my label hire any old company to come in and make a video for me. I'm going to write this myself, you know, I'm going to come up with a concept, so it's an extension of what's in the song, what's in the music. And that was a really special period, actually. You know, it was still undefined. Anything goes, anything could go. There were gizmos coming out, you know, like Harry boxes and blue screen stuff and so on that you could get creative with. And it still felt subversive, you know, because the mainstream stuff, you didn't, we were doing stuff that you didn't see in commercials, in car commercials and things, you know. Whereas nowadays, of course, you know, the state of the art is going to be in like a car commercial or something that has a big budget or a big feature film.
Well, it's, I think in the same way, I you know, the same way that we've seen sort of a paradigm shift in the last 10 years of, it's like every decade an artist has to tack on more and more skill sets to really break through. So watching the difference between the 70s and the 80s of just being in a band to, well, now you're in a band, but also you kind of have to be visual as well. And now it's the same thing. You have to be visual and you're in a band and you have to know how to market yourself. Like, it's just all the things that I think that record labels or, you know, managers or agencies used to do sold for the artist. Now the artist essentially has to do everything.
Well, like, you know, the story of Christopher Cross, where he was just selling a ton of records.
And then videos.
And then everyone saw what he looked like, and none of the girls wanted to listen to it anymore. Right. It's such a sad...
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Yeah, video... I think music videos hurt a lot of people, but then this whole other generation...
Well, now it's like, it's every band that comes out, it's like they have to look like models. It's kind of ridiculous. You see any new band out, it's, I mean, I think, like, you know, half of Arcade Fire is weird looking, but the other half, they're really good looking. You know, it's just like there needs to be, it's so visual, which is so odd because that's the opposite of what music kind of is, you know, because you can listen to music anywhere, but you only have to be one place to see it. And the fact that, like, you know, it's like visually you have to be a good looking person.
But you know what? I don't think that's new, though.
No,
I think the Rolling Stones, you know, benefited from the fact that they look good as well.
That's a
good, you know, they didn't look like male models, that's for sure. Yeah. You know, but they looked charismatic and they were interesting to look at.
Yeah, I want to get a collection of like all the weirdest, like the goofiest faces the Beatles ever made, because they were just supposed to be cute boys, but like you look at pictures of them, they're always just like, huh?
Yeah.
Were you aware at the time? So when She Blinded Me with Science broke. Were you aware, like, oh, I think there's a revolution that is happening right now? Did it feel that way at the time?
No, it didn't feel like a revolution at all. Actually, in as much as I can remember what it really felt like at all. No, not a revolution. I mean, what was quite interesting was that I was getting kudos from odd places. You know, I was getting people like George Clinton and Michael Jackson sort of complimenting me on my grooves, you know, and that was kind of nice. And the song was crossing over into you know, pretty nasty clubs in the South Bronx and so on. So that was all quite cool, you know, for a sort of a middle class English boy. You know, that was definitely quite exciting.
Was it? Did you enjoy being a pop star, or was it awkward, or what is it?
No, I didn't. I was awkward. It felt like I was in a fishbowl, really. You know, I mean, I wore little round glasses at the time, and people would just sort of, their jaws would drop if I walked in a room, and nobody was normal with me, you know. So it didn't feel good, really. It didn't, you know, it wasn't something that suited me naturally.
So when you say that they weren't normal towards you, like, what, you mean they were just, I don't know. Were they awkward, or were they super ass kissy, or were they douchey, or like what is, how is it that they
all of the above? I mean, my fans have always been quite polite. You know, they're not the kind that would rip you to shreds.
Right.
But in the industry, you know, I mean, I must have met a couple of dozen record company executives, each of which was the one that discovered me.
Oh, sure.
You know, and they hug you. You know, they're greasy, you know, and it costs you a fortune in dry cleaning fees, you know. It's like I had these beautiful suits and everything, but like after a record company meeting, I'd come away, it's like, ew.
I bet they just thought that was, I mean, like if in the 70s and the 80s, I bet like the record label system, they must have just thought like, this is never going to end. This is always going to be amazing because people are always going to want music, yeah. And we're always going to control everything,
yep.
And it's never going to go away. Like,
what else can I get made of gold? Yeah.
No kidding. Well, I mean, and it was true because there was only one way to get music out to the public. I mean, it was a process, but it started with, you know, a pressing plant, fleets of trucks, and manufacturing relationships with retail stores and malls, relationships with radio programmers. I put relationships in quotes there. You know, often involving brown envelopes or getting somebody's speedboat berthed or getting their kids through college or whatever. And basically they could pick or choose. You know, they got thousands of tapes through the door, and a guy would sit there and listen to them and pick something out, and they'd pluck out, you know, 50 artists, and that would be the public's choice at any given point in time. You know, these are the 50 artists we will give you to choose between. And each one of them we've invested $1 million or more in to put them in the studio and get them on the road and, you know, print out their satin tour jackets and all the rest of it. And it's like they were the kingmakers, really.
Wow.
And they must have believed that they had it all sewn up, because there was only half a dozen companies capable of doing that. Although they were competitive, the bosses all met and played tennis or golf at the weekends. And if they needed to change something, they could do it in a sort of oligopolistic way. Is that a word?
Let's say
it can be.
Oligarchistic?
No.
Oligopoly? Oligopoly?
Monopolistic, oligopolistic.
Yes, yeah, I like it. Oligopolistic. So did they lean on you to, well, you have to do this kind of music, or you have to follow up with this, or were you pretty much on your own?
Well, they assumed after the success of She Blinded Me with Science that I would milk that formula. Yeah, that was just an assumption.
The formula of the music video and...
Well, and they didn't out and say this, but, you know, behind my back, they'd be saying, right, what made it? It was quirky, British, funky pop, you know, synth pop, underdog character, you know, wacky hair, fun video. Let's go do that another 12 times, you know. And the assumption was in the music business that, you know, you work so hard to break something through that once you actually nail it, you know, you're going to refine that formula and do it over and over again. But the thing was, you know, I'm naturally adventurous, and that was, you know, She Blinded Me with Science was just one of a dozen things that I was trying out, you know, at the time. And I wanted to move on. In fact, the next real sort of chapter of my music career was a lot more personal, a lot more organic, you know, more atmospheric songs. And this didn't really fall in with their ideas. Now, they weren't able to lean on me. They weren't able to, you know, deprive me of my salary or anything. I mean, they had no way of exerting pressure on me other than the lack of cooperation. You know, I had a song after that called Hyperactive, which shot into the charts and then mysteriously fell, you know, like in the third week when it was absolutely on this trajectory, you know, we were saying number one, you know, and all the rest of it. It's getting played all over the radio, mysteriously dropped 10 places in the charts. And it turned out to be because of a political battle that was going on between the labels and the radio programmers. And so, you know, when something goes wrong, you do a post-mortem on it and you analyze all the reasons why it went wrong. You know, when something goes right, you just pat each other on the back and say, we're great. You know, you never analyze it and figure out, well, you know, how did that happen?
Can you figure that out, though? I mean, is it lightning in a bottle, or do you think that it is? Do you think that if you had enough data points that you could figure it out?
No, I don't think you can figure. I think lightning in a bottle is closer, you know. And in fact, what I've seen in other eras of my career, you know, like in the tech world and so on, it's like history will always record that some genius in a garage, you know, sort of like invented something, but in reality it was lightning in a bottle. It was a complete serendipitous moment, and history is the one that's at fault, because, you know, I mean, I'll give you an example, right? So history will record that Steve Jobs single-handedly invented the digital music business, whereas in reality Apple put out the Newton in 1988 or something.
I had one
complete and utter catastrophe. It was a disaster. Didn't work properly. They had to recall them. Everybody hated them. They got slagged off. Steve Jobs was out. Leckie, whatever his name was, came in. And then during the 90s, people started messing around with gadgets. You got the Palm Pilot. You know, you got these little devices and stuff. And somebody at Apple was going, "We're never going there again." You know, keep out of the miniature, you know, mobile hardware business. And in the music world, you know, we had MP3.com, we had Napster, we had the record companies suing Napster, the record companies owning Napster, starting their own portal. It was all just a complete disaster. Nothing was working at all. Everybody was exhausted. So one day, you know, Apple walks in and goes, excuse me, and we'd actually like to try a digital music service ourselves. And they go, take it, whatever. Good luck to you. You know, nice to get it off my plate. And so they came in like years and years after everybody else, you know, had tried and failed to establish a digital music business. And they got it right with the iPod and iTunes, and now own whatever it is, 78% of the market. And the history books will record. In fact, Steve Jobs' biographies already record this, that he single-handedly created the digital music business.
like early on, they were always like, here's a color display. Here's, you know, here's the Newton. Here's this printer. Here's this, that. Because they used to make
everything. They were known as the innovators.
Yeah.
But they took that original UI from Xerox.
Yes. But as far as getting a marketable home PC, that was their thing. And then they were like, let's do this. Let's make, you know,
it was Wozniak.
Lucy was, yeah, like, you know, we'll do the Lisa will be color. And then this will be that and that and that. We'll get it out to the schools. That was their big ploy, was to give it to schools so that kids would only know Apple. You know, that was sort of their plan. Didn't really work, but when that stuff happened in the early 90s and the late 80s with like the Newton and the stuff like that, and then that failed, and then they ousted Jobs, then they sort of took a different approach, which kind of became, it's sort of for a little while up to like 95-96 when you start seeing the PowerBook pop up in Mission Impossible and Independence Day,
yeah.
You know, and it's like, that's what saves the world is the fucking Macintosh PowerBook. Because the PC world was making cheaper. If you look at it at Apple, it was always $2,500. You still look now, it's $2,500.
Right.
It never got any cheaper. And then they sort of, nothing was working. So then they started to put it into movies, put it into TV show. And that's where all their marketing money in those days went to getting it into television and movies.
But here's the thing. So I formed a tech company in Silicon Valley in the early 90s. And in the early days when I was talking to investors, my board members would come in and they said to me after bringing in a potential investor one time, look, next time we bring somebody in, can you get the Apple's Macs off the desks? Like, could we maybe buy some cheap PCs and we'll let you know if we're bringing an investor and put your programmers on PCs? Because it's bad enough that we're asking them to invest in a company, you know, whose business is music. Let alone if they see Macs on the desktops, they're going to think you're just dreamers.
That was a huge, yeah, and that was a huge stigma too that you don't remember.
Who's the biggest company in the world right now, and what was their killer app?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's crazy because my dad worked for Hewlett Packard when I was a kid.
Right. And Hewlett Packard would say, you know, because they would hire me as a consultant and they'd listen to what I had to say. And then they end up saying, nah, you know what? People get kind of annoyed when we put loudspeakers in our computers because the guy, like in the next cubicle, gets upset because he's trying to crunch numbers in his database and there's music coming out, you know. So it's kind of really better for our customers if they're silent.
Wow.
Is that so? They hired you to try to figure out how to create entertainment with the machines as well?
No, not entertainment. It was the implementation of audio. They needed something to set them apart, you know, and so they, because everybody was Microsoft Intel. You know, Wintel, as it was known. So computer makers were looking for ways to set themselves apart. So they would think, well, do we need to do more with entertainment? You know, should we bundle movies or DVD games, you know, with our machines and stuff like that? So they were looking for any kind of an edge. And I was up there in Silicon Valley, but I was from the entertainment world. And, ne'er the two shall meet at that point.
And so did you actively seek to consult, or did people start approaching you? He's like, oh, I think Thomas Dolby knows...
A little bit of both. I got an offer from Interval Research, which is a research company founded by Paul Allen, who was the other Microsoft founder, and it was in the mode of Xerox PARC, you know, and it was very close, same street actually. But they hired me to basically try and come up with some interesting interactive music applications. So I had a little team of 10 programmers, and we came up with apps that are just like what you'd buy on your iPhone now for 99 cents, you know, like here are some blobs, you move them around and you remix music and you send it to your friends or whatever. We were doing that, you know, on the web, basically, in the middle of the 90s. And, of course, nobody wanted to pay for it. What would happen is we'd take it to Netscape or Yahoo or AOL, and some middle management guy would look me in the eye and he'd go, wow, this guy's gotten VCs to fund this cool game, and I'm going to make sure that we have it, and I'm going to put the Yahoo logo on it and pretend it's ours, and his VCs are going to pay for the whole thing. I'm going to look like a god.
Oh, jeez.
So basically, you know, we had millions and millions of eyeballs because we had these great deals with all these people, and we were using our own funding to pay for it. It was the most disastrous business model. And it should have gone up in smoke at the end of the 90s, like, you know, most other ridiculous dot-coms did. But we had one deal out of, when the dust settled, out of all of this, we'd made a little synthesizer that was as small as you could make it, you know, smallest footprint, bits and bytes shaved off here and there, so that you could download it in a web page. So it would basically let you click on things, and it would come in your browser. It would download and install itself as a plugin. And because we've made it really small and efficient, it was exactly what the world's largest mobile phone company needed to play ringtones in their phone. So along came Nokia and said, hey, could you send some engineers out to Finland and see if you can shoehorn your little synth into our phones? And we did that, and we did that deal. And when the bubble burst at the end of the century, we had one deal that made sense with somebody that would actually pay decent money, and that was with Nokia.
And you wrote all those original ringtones that came...
I wrote some of them. I programmed... my team programmed most of them, including the infamous Nokia polyphonic ringtone.
Was that the...
I didn't write. That was written in the 19th century. Okay, back to the lightning in a bottle. Right, so here's the thing. I'm going to tell you the story of that ringtone.
Okay,
right?
Okay.
You can always edit it out later.
No. I want to keep it.
All right, so circa, I would say 1992 or 93, Nokia had only one building at that point. Even though they were already the world's largest mobile phone company, they were all in one building outside of Oslo. And one night, a marketing guy is walking past the lab, and he hears what he thinks is music coming out, and he pokes his head around the door and says, ah, you got it playing music now. And an engineer with a screwdriver is going, no, I'm just trying to figure out which the most annoying frequency is for the ring. And the marketing guy says, oh, but you should get it to play tunes. Could you do that? And he goes, yeah, I could probably do that. And so he programs in some tunes, gives the device to the marketing guy, who takes it into a marketing meeting, and they say, this is great. Musical ringtones, fantastic. Let's ship it. And the lawyers come and go, wait a minute. You can't just ship music on a phone. the lawyers, of course, always want to get involved. Oh, why not? Well, you'd have to pay millions and do deals with Sony and Warners and all the writers and stuff. And somebody says, well, what about if it's a dead guy? And they said, well, that's probably okay if he's been dead for 75 years. So, well, your tunes, are any of those by dead guys? Yes, this one that goes diddly. So why don't we just ship it with that and see how it goes?
Oh, my God. Who was the dead guy?
I can't remember his name. Grand Valse is the name of the thing. But he's a waltz composer, like a contemporary of Johann Strauss or something. And so they shipped it, and it became, the most successful jingle of all time.
Wow.
So, complete lightning in a bottle.
Wow. And then, of course, that all exploded, and then they did figure out how to license all the stuff, and they did figure out how to bring the lawyers in. And
well, we my company was successful during a narrow window where the ringtones were still bleeps. We put this little very, very simplistic synth in their phones, and they started shipping them in mass market phone. There was no audio chip in there. There was no Sound Blaster card in there. They didn't want the expense of
Sound Blaster.
They didn't want the liability of buying a chip from Yamaha or somebody whose plant could get hit by a monsoon and blow their whole thing. So it had to be on the CPU of the actual phone itself, which is a puny little processor. So we got four voices going for that ringtone thing, and that was the best we could do. And it was kind of a MIDI set of sounds, but it was a subset. So, piano also worked for guitar and oboe and various other things. So they shipped all of these things, and there was a period of time where all of their competitors came and licensed it as well to keep up with Nokia. But then I didn't like the way they sounded, so I actually... It created a new file format along with my engineers called RMF, which included samples. So now you could, it's like the first Fairlight, where it was the first time you could actually play samples of real recordings in a phone. And ironically, that I shot myself in the foot, because it went from there. All they had to do was multiply the numbers and go from 32 to 64 to 128K, capacity. And suddenly now you could use real recordings. You could use, actual George Michael in your phone instead of a bleepy rendition of Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go. You could have, but having an actual recording meant going to Sony and licensing the masters. So now suddenly it was all about the big record companies and the telcos, so it was Sony and Verizon doing deals directly with each other. And there was no need for this sort of cottage market that we'd created with the bleepy ringtones.
Was there any way that when looking back, is there anything you go, oh, I should have done this that you could have jumped into?
Yeah, in hindsight, But nobody's that clever, really. If anybody tells you there was a master plan, you know, there was no master plan.
Well, that's part of the lightning in the bottle. You can't know that that's going to happen. You can't know that that's going to catch on. No.
You probably, it's probably, the key actually probably is just being very alert to when the lightning strikes in a bottle, you know.
Right.
And then focusing all your energy onto that before your bank account runs out.
Well, you can't know any better that something is going to catch on than that guy, than that that dead composer who could have said someday everyone's going to know the song. They're
right.
Not going right. to. He just had no way. You just have no way of knowing. Since you innovate in that way and you innovate with sound, was there ever anything that you were working on that you really thought, like, this is going to be the thing that never caught on? Like, do you have, like, a personal pet project that you're like, shit, I just haven't found the right way to make this work yet?
I'm bad at timing, you know. It's like I'm usually spot on with what's going to happen, but I'm just very bad about when it's going to happen. And, you know, I mean, an example would be that in about 1992, 93, you could download compressed music files from CompuServe, and people were doing it. So you'd think, wow, well, everybody's on the internet. You can rip a CD and put it online on a forum or something, and everybody can get their music for free. And this is going to go absolutely postal, you know, overnight. But years later, it still hadn't caught on. And then, you know, several years later, for no apparent reason that I could make out, suddenly it exploded. Suddenly the downloading phenomenon just caught fire. And it was everywhere. It was every time you open the newspaper, it was about the piracy thing, you know, about the statistics, the music companies losing money and stuff like that. And I have no idea to this day what triggered the actual explosion. Because I thought, well, maybe this is never going to happen. I was bemused by it. I spent at least 2 or 3 years thinking, how come that didn't happen? And then suddenly it went off. It's like when you light a firework, you know, and everybody stands back and think, oh, it's fizzled. And then somebody approaches it.
Do you think it's... Because I remember for a long time you had to have a special disk burning, drive outside your computer. But then all of a sudden computers just have a thing where you could just put a CD in and it would put the songs onto it. Do you think that's what finally made, like, now everyone's pouring music onto their computers digitally?
I don't know if that's what it was. I think it might have been
a generational thing. I think it was maybe the right age group sort of coming of age around 97, 98, 99. And then kind of going, well, I don't want to fucking pay for music. I think before that, people were, I don't know, and maybe, and then those young people creating a much easier, more viable delivery service. Because I always think the idea needs the right platform.
Yeah.
Much in the same that, you know, everyone's trying to figure out digital content and how do you monetize digital content and how do you, you know, and I still feel like the right platform hasn't really come along yet.
Yeah.
Much in the way that podcasting was essentially just, you know, weird Og Vorbis, super early adopter niche file formats, and until iTunes was like, here is an easy delivery system for all this shit over here. That it just, the right idea needs the right delivery system. And those are two kind of, a lot of times, two different events.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's certainly true. And if you look, I mean, going back to Apple and iTunes for a second, if you look back, you go, well, they had it all wrapped up because they had the shop front and they had the hardware, you know, the sexy hardware device. But the thing is, I mean, they weren't the only company that had it wrapped up like that. You know, in the Wintel world, there were others that had it, seemed to have it, you know, ambushed and still didn't succeed.
I had my Winamp player, and then I could get the different skins on my...
Winamp. Wow, I remember that one.
Yeah.
I mean,
great.
I
remember thinking the iPod... when the iPod was in... I was in college, and I was in a internet technologies class. We were talking about the iPod, which was coming out the next day. And I was like, this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen in my life. I have a hard drive right here with all my music, plus this awesome book of CDs.
I can remember, you know, when you're in Silicon Valley, you do a lot of meetings, you know, over a Starbucks or something. I can remember on separate occasions, a guy sitting down and telling me about cells of social activity, you know, where basically people are connected to each other. So it's sort of like email, but instead of it being a private thing, you're sort of connected to all of your friends. And so you have these cells and it would grow and grow and grow. And I'm like, well, sounds intriguing. You know, I can remember that as a day. I can remember another time when a company told me about community TV channels, about the idea of having a channel with 10,000 different shows on it, you know, so that even your local polo club could have their own little channel on it and stuff. And in both cases, it was at least 5 years, if not more, before you heard about any actual product that was making an impact in that particular sector.
Oh, wow. So are you, how active are you on social media? Does it, do you...
Averagely active for somebody of my age, I think. You know, I write it myself. You know, I would be embarrassed to have somebody else do it for me, which some celebs do. You know, it would never feel right to have somebody else do it. So I do write it myself. And I mean, I use it for promotion, I have to say. You know, I'll write something saying, only a few tickets left for tonight's show at the second show at the Hollywood Forever, you know. And sometimes I just do things for fun, you know. Facebook is more like, I used to blog a lot. I've kind of cut that back because I do more, spend more time on Facebook and Twitter and things like that. And my only regret actually is that, you know, back in the day, even before blogging, when it was like online forums and things like that, people wrote really in-depth analyses of my songs and lyrics and things like that. And now it's down to 140 characters. So, yeah.
Were they right, or did anyone ever get it, or were you?
I didn't mind if they were right or wrong. You know, I just liked the fact that the intelligent people were indulging in analyzing this stuff. You know, and they even wrote fan fiction type things where they take characters from my songs, you know, Europa and the Submarine, and they write their own little, you know, things where they just took off on the mythology really of my songs.
When did you go online for the, when did you start going online?
Well, I was online from the 80s, you know, with a TRS-80, you know, Radio Shack with acoustic couplers.
And, I had a TRS-80.
And, you know, when you were on tour in those days, that was the only connectivity you had other than pulling over the tour bus with a pocket full of quarters, you know, by a phone booth, you know.
Who else is out there at that point? Because it almost kind of feels, to me, it almost sounds like, you know, it almost sounds like, you know, you're... Vespucci or something just out in the sea, and then there really was just not a lot of people with ships at that point.
No,
like,
there weren't.
Oh, there's a guy way over there. Hey, what's that fucking guy talking about?
No, it was exactly like that. Yeah. And one night I got into a chat with Barry Manilow.
I love that he was techie.
Yeah, he was very techie and he was hilarious.
How did you know? How did you guys find each other?
Like, because he was called Barry Manilow.
I write the blogs. Yeah,
everybody else in there was like a tour manager, you know.
I remember just hearing about the early days. So was this on any particular like where were you going? Were they news groups or was it forums or?
I'm not sure if they had that kind of construct yet, really. You know, I don't know what it would have been in those
days. Was it like
days.
A chat relay?
Something like that, yeah, like an IRC.
Just looked like war games.
Yeah, because, you know, even when you hear about the early days of cellular technology, it was like, well, there were only so many channels, and so there were like, you know, just a handful. So if you wanted to make a call, other people had to not be using theirs.
Yeah.
That you might, you know, you might pick up and go, oh, sorry, you're using, you know. Like,
My mother had the Polestar in a bag, like unzip it and then pull. It's like you're calling to drop a nuclear bomb. You know, like, dial the thing. You know?
I'll tell you what, though, necessity is the mother of invention. You know, it's like you get when you're spoiled for choice, when you just have ultimate channels, then you just laziness creeps in. So, at every stage of my career, I'm at my most creative when I'm working in sort of rarefied air, you know, because it's still too new to really get your arms around.
It's interesting to me that you're such a technological guy, but having been to your house is not. I mean, you have that really cool sort of sciencey piece on your, you know, like above the. What is that, by the way? Is it like an
Above my fireplace?
Yeah,
it's like a switchboard generator from a telephone exchange.
Oh, it's really
cool. Yeah.
But your house is very not. I mean, it's not. That doesn't seem that technological.
You know, I go there to escape it, really. You know, it's the last thing I want to do for relaxation.
Sure.
I just like to go for a walk in the marshes or, you know, sit and stare out at the sea.
It's a night. It's really cool. And there's not, guys, there's not sand. There's just like billions and billions of shell pieces on the beach. And it feels really cool on your feet.
Yeah.
It flips me out. Like, when I was in high school, Aliens Ate My Buick was in my cassette player.
Nice.
Back when people needed cassette players, Kyle.
Very appropriate. I wish that was open.
Oh, that I knocked out. I know. I would have spilled water on myself.
On my cassette.
You know, so it like that album to me was like, that was so much of my senior year of high school was Aliens Ate My Buick. And so if you had said to me, like, someday you're going to go to Thomas Dolby's house and just hang out. I don't think I would have believed it. I don't think I would have believed it.
And maybe you didn't.
Maybe I didn't. Did it not happen?
Fuck you guys. What?
It was crazy as Thomas Dolby was thinking at that time, I wonder if I'm going to meet some kids in high school right now.
Oh, well, you know, I'll tell you a funny story. So recently I read in two different Tom York interviews that he went to school, same school as me, true, Abingdon School, but that one day he walked into the practice block at his school and there was this guy with a synthesizer that he'd built himself. And it was Thomas Dolby, and this is what inspired him to get into, you know,
America.
So now we went to the same school, but I had been gone for 8 years by the time any of Radiohead ever went there.
No, no, and you got to just take the credit on that one.
Well, well, yes and no. I mean, in a way, I'm not sure if I can let it go by, you know?
Are you just not admitting you were the creepy guy that hung out at high school way too long?
That's the song. It's based on him. I'm a creep.
Yes! So what happens now is basically Thomas starts to flutter a little bit, and then we find out he's just been a holographic projection this entire time from that switchblade.
He's really
above
sitting at his fireplace.
He's really,
right,
yeah, he's really actually staring at the beach. Do you know Tom York? Have you ever worked with
him? Nope, no, never met him.
No, oh, okay.
Actually, it's good. You got me thinking now. It's like I could do all the podcasts in a night.
You could.
If
you could do that just like that, yeah.
No, this. You can't do that.
No, you can. In 5 years, someone else is going to do it. Right. In 5 years, someone's going to actually have it. Yeah. So in general, everything good? You happy?
Yeah, no, really happy. I mean, I've had an incredible 5 or 6 years where I've done exactly what I wanted artistically. This is sort of since I came back to music and not had to compromise anywhere along the road, you know. So I've had nobody breathing down my neck, never looked at a sheet of figures or an Excel and thought, maybe I should do this instead and cut some costs or make more money or whatever. Purely artistic driven decisions all the way down the road. And it's been absolutely great, but I'm not sure if it's sustainable.
Well, if it seemed that, you know, something you were working on was going to blow up like top of the charts again, would you, and this might be a dumb question, but would you want that to happen or would you not because of all the shit that comes with it?
Well, I think it is much more celebrity driven now even than it was when I started. You know, because you could, when I started, you could be a wonderful musician and not really give a toss about your appearance, you know, and that was sort of okay, you know. But these days that's just not true because it's just generation by generation, each new star that's come through has ticked more and more boxes, you know, like you were saying, you've also got to be able to market yourself and the rest of it. And, you know, you look at these awful talent shows, but the average contestant on there, you know, can sing and dance like a fool and they look like a model, you know, and I don't know how it happens any more than I know how athletes keep breaking world records, you know. But our species is evolving and we're just getting better at jumping over a bar or you know, running around a track or whatever, and that's similar with entertainers.
Well, I think a lot of it probably has to do with the localization of our global culture. Is that it's I assume that a lot of those people were out there before, but there was just no way to find them. And so now you could, you know, you could live in any, you could live in sub-Saharan Africa, but if you had an internet connection, you uploaded the right video, then all of a sudden they're going to find, you know, like people are going to. Everyone has a beacon in their pocket and in their home, which we didn't have before.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's certainly true. But, I mean, I think the ante has just gone up and up and up in terms of the technical ability.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is that, you know, the main consumers of music, whether they're paying for it or pirating it, are, you know, hot young people that are, you know, looking to mate with somebody. I mean, that's just it's always been that way. And the primary performers they're going to pay any attention to is going to be people they want to fuck.
Yeah, that's true.
I'm a 55-year-old bald white guy, you know. So I'm sort of ruling myself out. I mean, by rights, I should be producing. I should be in the back seat, you know, out of the limelight.
Yes, but
so
you just walk outside Sunset Strip. Say you're a 55-year-old bald white guy. No problem. No problem.
I still do believe, though, that content has a lot more say necessarily than it used to, that the right piece of content at the right time, that it doesn't matter who you are, what you look like, I think people are more even in as much as the like the American idolization of our culture, I still believe that so much, because we're a niche culture and so much weirdness has been embraced, that I don't think it. I don't think it necessarily. I mean, maybe to go that pop star track, like the, you know, the Britney or the Gaga track, maybe. But I still think you can look like whatever. But if you make a cool thing, then enough people are gonna, you know, you can reach enough people directly, and it still can work.
Yeah. No, I think you're probably right. And I think also things, you know, it's like swings and roundabouts, really. I mean, you know, I'll give you a good example. So there's this band in the UK that I used to produce, Prefab Sprout, mm-hmm. who I adore. And I did 2.5 albums for them and loved those albums. And they're fronted by a genius songwriter called Paddy McAloon, who is very, very reclusive and very reactionary. And his health is not that good. And he lives in the far north of England. And he's gotten very ornery over the years, and his stuff has become more and more rare, but he doesn't really do interviews very much. And because of his bad health, he's put on quite a lot of weight. He's got, you know, white hair and a beard, and he wears these sort of strange dystopian specs and things like this. And he's 5 years ago, if he was reviewed, people might sort of say, yes, but have you seen Paddy recently? But now he's gotten to a point where he's viewed as a sort of mythical character. and a really interesting thing happened. He recorded a new album, and there'd been a tribute site called the Prefab Sprout Project, where fans had been, because he hadn't been putting much out, fans had been doing tribute versions of his songs or writing songs in the style of, right? Most of them were pretty average, pretty bad. There's one guy on there who's actually very talented and sounds quite a lot like Paddy and is able to write songs, you know, that actually you could almost imagine would be a Paddy B-side. So here's what happens. So Paddy records a new album, hands it into his record company, and a secretary in the company leaks it to SoundCloud. So now there are 10 original Prefab Sprout masters out on the internet flying around, and word goes out that they've been leaked. But somebody else says, no, that's the Prefab Sprout Project. That's not really Paddy. That's a tribute thing. And it becomes very, very hazy, you know, whether this thing is real or not. And so this legend has grown up in the last 6 months of this legendary album that's going to come out. Have we actually heard the real thing, or it's almost like, you know, Elvis has left the building. And now Paddy has been photographed once or twice up in his native place, wearing a white suit with a cane, dark glasses, you know, standing by a stream. And he's like the Yeti. I mean, he's become this mythical creature. And in Britain, we don't have very many of them. We don't have very many indigenous, homegrown sort of weirdos. You know, what we're really good at is recycling great grooves that we steal from Africa or Jamaica or Detroit or wherever it is. You know, we put a bit of a cool twist on them and re-export them to the rest of the world. And you guys all think it's original. but in fact, our dirty little secret is that we have very little indigenous music, you know. So here is a true indigenous original that, you know, dwells in the hills of County Durham, and people are suddenly very, very excited about him.
Oh, that's wow. really cool. That's an awesome story. Yeah. So we'll check out the Prefab Sprouts as well. Well, this has been so much fun, and I hope that you get some rest. I hope that you just you can go home and stare out at the sea for a month or so.
Yes.
What's next?
Well, I've got to edit video from my tour. So I just finished 3 months of touring, and I did the film, and then in the middle section of the show, in the end section, I played songs. The middle section of the show, I interviewed local celebs. And they might be musicians, they might be writers, sound designers, and so on. Just people in each city.
That's what I was going to do.
All right. Well, yeah. I did it.
No, I mean, that's what I was going to do with you, when you asked me to do. But I'm
just breaking your balls.
My balls are broken.
Okay. So we filmed these interviews, and they included people like Reggie Watts,
yep.
Nice. Like Walter Murch, mm-hmm. legendary sound designer who did all of Coppola's stuff, you know, won an Oscar for Apocalypse Now and did The Conversation and American Graffiti and stuff like that, through to Storm Large, who came on stage and did a version of Key to Her Ferrari, through to in Hollywood, I interviewed 2 film/TV composers, Michael Giacchino, who does most of J.J. Abrams stuff, Star Trek and Lost and Alias and so on.
Lost. Got paid every week for that. Genius. No, but he is amazing. I love the Alias theme too. Yeah. Like, that guy writes really cool stuff.
He does. And Dave Porter, who did Breaking Bad, which featured 2 of my songs. So I just interviewed them on stage and talked about, so it's kind of like what I'm doing is sort of a bit like Inside the Actor's Studio, but for the sound and music world, you know, where that show gets a different kind of interview, you know, out of an actor or a director, you know, than you'd see on, you know, Letterman. And so I'm going to try and make a show out of it. So I'm just going to edit these videos and put them on YouTube as a series and see if I can get somebody to back me to go do it for real.
Oh, that's a really cool idea.
Very cool.
Yeah. You, I'm pretty sure I heard you in the A1 car wash, right? On Breaking Bad?
Yes, Hyperactive.
Yes, Hyperactive.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, is a really fun, so I hope this doesn't upset you. It's a really fun song to do karaoke because it's the song's so energetic. And I love the videos. The video is still burned into my brain of the sort of puppety, like your body's all... And now I can't get, and now it's what's in my head is I just want the key to her Ferrari. Like that fucking album. Now I'm gonna go back and listen to Aliens in My View.
Sing more of his songs.
I just want the, how am I doing? It's good to see you, and you know, it's been fun to kind of become email pals with you, and anytime you're over here, please let me know, and I would love to take you out to a meal.
I'll do that, Chris. That would be great, and thanks for having me on.
Of course, yeah, good to see you. Thomas Dolby. Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Cool.
Where's enjoy your burrito coming? Is that like your catchphrase?
It's a catchphrase that...
Are there actually burritos here? Because if so, I could murder one.
Do you want a burrito?
Well, I'm Lisa and I are going to grab something before I have to go to the airport.
Enjoy your burrito, just really quickly, was when Jonah first moved to Los Angeles, he was broke, and he used to like to go to this one burrito shack, and... the only good part of his day was eating that burrito, and halfway through he would get really depressed because he knew he was about to be done with it, and then the burrito would be done. And
real dark time.
Yeah.
Real dark time.
And so he said what he ended up having to do was to learn to enjoy the burrito as it was happening. And so on one of our first episodes of the podcast, 445 episodes ago, he told the story, and then it sort of became this mantra, and at the end we said, oh, enjoy your burrito. In other words, enjoy the present as it's happening. And so that's the way that we end the podcasts now, because we live so much in the future or the past and never really just kind of like in the moment. So
I put it in the most simplest of terms, food.
Enjoy your burrito.
In my household we have a burrito moment. because once with small children, we had three kids, and we used to, when we couldn't be bothered to cook, we would go to Tres Amigos and bring back burritos. And at one point, this happens with small kids. You know, my wife was so upset with what was going on that having just gone out to the Tres Amigos, she threw the burrito on the floor, jumped as high as she could, and the contents exploded all over the kitchen cabinets. You know, I mean, like in 360 perfect. So this is known as a burrito moment.
That's great.
I don't want to shoot that like on a red camera.
Like with the Wachowskis.
Yes.
Phantom cam.
Just put a bunch of cameras all around in a circle and explode the burrito in the middle. And just watch it spin.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.